Good morning. Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. Your panel this morning is, to my right, Justice Ann Gardner. To my left, Justice Sue Walker. I'm Leanne Dofino. We have one case set for oral submission this morning. There was a case ahead of you, but they settled yesterday. So you're the whole show today.
May it please the court, I'm Keith Hampton, representing Ms. Ahmad. The reason I had requested oral argument was after I got the state's brief, there was quite a number of procedural arguments that were advanced, and I thought that oral argument might be helpful to the court if I answered some of those and covered some of those issues. The issues primarily dealing with statute of limitations and the tolling of the paragraph, If I'm able to, I'll address a little bit of sufficiency or anything else of interest to the court.
Is that an issue of fact or an issue of law?
It's an issue of law. I think you're looking at it's a jurisdictional issue. The first, setting aside the estoppel argument that I advanced on my reply brief, let me back up a little bit. The state had represented to the trial court that its original document that it filed did not state an offense. If it doesn't state an offense, then it is not an indictment. It's not an indictment, then it has no ability to toll the statute of limitations. I relied on that and put that in the brief. The state now argues for the first time on appeal that, in fact, the first document did state an offense. And so that's one of the arguments that I want to counter. Basically, here's what happened. The person in this case was arrested in 2002. 2.5 years later, in July of 2004, she is indicted for two things: false report to a police officer and possession of a hoax bomb. First time she's given notice to what penal code offenses that she has allegedly violated. Motion to quash is filed along with a writ. Both are litigated extensively and turned down on procedural grounds. So we've now returned, and the only time that you can reach these issues, the issues of statute of limitations and the sufficiency of the tolling paragraph, is now. This is your first opportunity, even though there have been two previous opinions, what are been referred to as Ahmad 1 and Ahmad 2. So this is actually Ahmad 3. The state insists that a document that they filed in 2003 was and did constitute an indictment for tampering. My argument, assuming that they are not a stop from taking the exact 180-degree different position that they took in the trial court, if they're not a stop, then let me answer and explain why that first document is not an indictment. The controlling case is Teal by the Court of Criminal Appeals. Teal lets you know that Studer, which seemed to stand for the proposition that any document would be an indictment, and another case called Cook, where they left out the name of any victim, and is therefore not an indictment. In between those two things, the court came out with, how do you determine when a piece of paper is really an indictment? The test is this: is it clear enough that the defendant can identify which penal code provision is alleged? And Teal is at 230 Southwest 3rd, 173. But it has to be clear enough so the defendant can identify which penal code provision is alleged. Well, the state is arguing that the penal code provision is tampering with evidence. Now, in that first document, it had two counts. First count was tampering, apparently, trying to be alleged, but it applied only to private lawsuits, Well, tampering with evidence is not applicable in private lawsuits. There's no authority for it. There's two cases cited by the state, neither of which support its position. Both of them are criminal cases. One's a JP case where misdemeanors are being prosecuted. The other case is apparently, it's a criminal prosecution, but apparently the underlying offense is a state termination of parental rights. So it's not KB Holmes versus Janet DeMott or a divorce case. These are official proceedings, which is the phrase used in the statute. So on the face of the indictment, the defendant certainly couldn't know what penal code offense that she was being charged with there, nor can you discern it from its reading. It's pretty badly written. Count two, the state argues, is also tampering with evidence. The problem with that is that in order to be guilty of tampering with evidence, the person has to, knowing that an investigation is underway, he makes, presents, or uses something with knowledge of its falsity. That never, in the paragraph, in that count two, in that document that they're insisting is an indictment, nowhere is it alleged that the bomb, the live, true training bomb, World War II training bomb, described that distinctly in count two of that document, is not false. It's not false in reality, and it's not alleged to be false. So reading the second count, you can't come to the conclusion that they're alleging tampering with evidence. There's more that could suggest that they're actually talking about unlawful possession of an explosive device, because they say it's a World War II training bomb. They may be alleging just false report to a peace officer, because they allege that in their count, their wordy count too as well. And that's the problem. You're supposed to be able to read the indictment and understand without too much squinting of the eyes to figure out what offense you're being charged with.
Okay, so if the original charging instrument charged tampering with evidence, how does that toll the statute of limitations for false alarm or report or possession of or use of a hoax bomb, whatever
possession
that is?
Possession of a hoax bomb, that is exactly.
So how does that toll the statute of limitations?
I don't think it does. Just to go ahead and assume then for the moment that for the sake of argument that they've convinced you that really tampering with evidence really was alleged in that first indictment. They still fail because the tolling paragraph in what is undisputably the indictment from 2004, which does clearly allege false report and possession of a hoax bomb, doesn't allege tampering, that indictment has a tolling paragraph, which is necessary, and it's supposed to plead facts, it's supposed to refer to that first document, and it's supposed to constitute the same conduct. Well, possession of a hoax bomb and tampering with a real one aren't the same conduct. You just can't get there. That nowhere mentioned in the first document is even a hint of hoax bomb. So that's the requirement under really this court's cases in Ex parte Smith, which I rely on, and McAllister that came before it, which is the test there, which, by the way, is also depending upon the Court of Criminal Appeals opinion in Hernandez. And this court was actually slightly ahead of the curve there because you all already came to the conclusion that that should be the test in McAllister. But a month before Ex parte Smith, this court issued Ex parte in Smith 1 month after the Hernandez case, but you're already there. It's got to be the same conduct. You've got to prove it. I mean, you've got to allege it, and you've got to show it. And they're not held to the same standard as an indictment, but the tolling paragraph has at least got to tell you certain things. In this case, it doesn't even tell you what the offense is. Among the many other deficiencies in it, all of which are listed in the brief, it is worse than in Ex parte Smith, where the tolling paragraph was found to be deficient. At least in Smith, they said that he was charged with an assault. The problem there was assault against who and when, among the other deficiencies. Well, here we have the tolling paragraph. All it says is, on the 6th day of August 2003, a complaint was duly filed in the 213th Criminal District Court of Tarrant County, Texas, charging said defendant with an offense arising out of the same conduct. Well, that's different. They're not even alleging that it is the same conduct. It must be the same conduct. Otherwise, it doesn't toll the statute. So it's like I argue in my brief, it is worse than the case in Smith, where you reversed on exactly those grounds. Now, significantly, the state does not contest the merits of what I just argued regarding the tolling paragraph. Their arguments are purely procedural, and they've come in sort of two waves, their reply brief and their served reply brief. And I just want to go over those. In relation to the statute of limitations argument, they argue that it's forfeited because it was not presented to the jury. Well, you don't have to present it to the jury. TITA, which the state cites in this case and then concedes that you're permitted to make the argument in a pretrial motion to dismiss to the trial court, and whether you go to a jury or not largely depends on trial strategy for one thing, but also if you're entitled to it, which is there's got to be some factual dispute. Well, there wasn't a factual dispute in this case, so wouldn't be any jury instruction. And we're not complaining about the jury charge. So that is somewhat of a rabbit trail that sort of leads nowhere. The other argument, which they've emphasized twice, is that this case, the law of the case doctrine, whereby when the court holds something, in that case, we're back again in some subsequent proceeding, that's going to control with certain exceptions. Otherwise, you're going to be controlled by that. You did not, the law of the case doctrine does not apply to dicta. In Ex parte Ahmad, you made a fleeting reference in a section called background that tampering was alleged in the first indictment. You never had to reach that issue. It wouldn't matter if tampering had been alleged or if something else had been alleged. You would have been, because the entire case came down to a procedural question, which is, can you raise any of it, whether it's meritorious or not? And the answer is no, you can't. This is the first time that you can. So that argument about law of the case doctrine, you are not ensnared by dicta in a previous case. It only applies to legal resolutions, which you never had. So that procedural argument is not going to work either. The controlling case there is Howlett. It's cited in the state's brief. I think it may be cited in my reply brief, but it's Howlett. I can give the cite. That's the last discussion or the most recent discussion of the law of the case doctrine, and it emphasizes, also points out there's an exception where if you got it wrong and you're in a subsequent proceeding, you're not helpless or constrained or, you know, strapped down and can't address it. The procedural arguments regarding tolling are this. They say, the state argues that the brief, I didn't brief it. Well, I devoted 5 pages to it. It's not clear enough, they argue. Well, it's clear enough that they respond to it. I cite the cases I've just said to you, which are on point, on tolling. And that finally, they argue that this isn't preserved, that the complaint is not preserved. To that, I would just point this out, and I would ask the state to either concede that this error is preserved or explain what more can be done to preserve a complaint like this. Had two pretrial motions, timely filed and ruled on by the court, specifically alleging tolling, a pretrial writ, two appeals, and a post-submission motion in arrest of judgment. What more can a lawyer do to preserve a complaint than all of those things? The other thing is, if they defend preservation of the complaint and say it's somehow waived, I would remind the court of the principles of complaint preservation. And they are that under Zillander and Langston, all that is required, what the Court of Criminal Appeals says, all that is required is that the complaint be made in a timely fashion to a court who's in a position to do something about it clearly enough for the other side to be able to respond. We've litigated this for now over 5 years. I cannot imagine how the state is not on notice about the two complaints about statute of limitations. And I'd ask them, you know, to either concede that it is well preserved or explain how it is not. If there are no other questions, I've got 5 minutes in rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is David Curl. First of all, appellant's first argument is that the first indictment was not an indictment because there was a mistake in it. That issue was settled as long ago as 1977. The Court of Criminal Appeals in Ex Parte Slavin said that a claim that the first indictment was void is not going to get you anywhere on court.
What does the indictment charge? What offense does the original indictment charge?
It charged tampering with evidence. And the second thing I wanted to say about is this invocation of Teal. Teal doesn't stand for the proposition that any mistake in an indictment makes it not be an indictment. Certainly, if there was a mistake in the first indictment, it certainly attempted to charge tampering, as this court held in the previous pretrial appeal. So, you know, his complaints just are not, there's nothing there.
How does an indictment for tampering with evidence toll the statute of limitations for the offense of false alarm or report or possession or use of a hoax bomb?
Well, the standard for what the first indictment has to do to toll is set out in Hernandez from the Court of Criminal Appeals. All it has to do is cover the same conduct, the same act, or the same transaction. And there is absolutely no dispute that this is the same transaction. So, you know, there's no – appellant has never made a serious argument that the first indictment would not satisfy the Hernandez standard if it had actually charged tampering. His complaint is that it doesn't properly charge tampering, so it's not an indictment.
But didn't the state file a motion to dismiss the first indictment on the ground that it didn't state an offense?
We did, but we don't believe that that should stop us because estoppel requires detrimental reliance, and appellant did not have any detrimental reliance. Also, it was another proceeding. It wasn't this judge in this trial.
What?
But if you take a position in open court, on the record, in writing, how can you now come back behind that and say, oh, no, it really did state an offense?
Well, estoppel is not just barring contradictory positions. It bars contradictory positions when there's detrimental reliance by the other side, and our argument is there isn't. And also, it's not a question of what we can argue. It's a question of what the trial court can decide. The trial court can decide that the first indictment stated the offense of tampering. So we don't think that there's any place.
But the trial court dismissed. On your motion, it ruled that it did not state an offense and dismissed.
Well, I'm talking about that was a different trial court. I'm talking about in this trial, when the trial court addressed appellant's motion to quash, our trial court was entitled to find that the first indictment was all right. It's a question of law. We don't believe it's a question of fact, and we believe the judge had that authority. We cited on page 15 of our brief there is authority for the proposition that tampering applies to civil cases. And even if it didn't, that would just mean that we made a mistake in our indictment. It wouldn't mean that this somehow was not an indictment. One of the main things I want to point out is appellant keeps harping about he did to preserve it, but he's conflating two very seriously different issues. The main argument about preservation that we're making is that if he wants to complain about that tolling paragraph, what we would advise him to do, since he wants us to instruct him, is he should have objected to that tolling paragraph. He should have said to the judge, that tolling paragraph is inadequate. There's a problem with that tolling paragraph. What he argued to the trial court was that the state can never prove tolling because the first indictment was not an indictment. the trial court had never ruled upon and was never asked to rule upon whether that tolling paragraph was properly worded. And it's just, we think it's outrageous for appellant to argue that he preserved that complaint.
Well, excuse me, but we prefer courtesy in this court and address the issues. Don't keep attacking the other side, please.
Well, he asked me to. I'm sorry, Your Honor. He asked me to tell him what I thought was defective, and I just was trying to respond.
I accept your apology.
Thank you. Finally, the TEDA case involved a complaint that there was no tolling paragraph at all. We think that's different than our case, where appellant is complaining both that he's complaining on appeal that the tolling paragraph was improperly worded, but he never presented that to the trial court, and he complained in the trial court that the state couldn't prove the tolling or couldn't prove tolling, but he didn't make a jury issue of it, and we believe it's a question that should have been submitted to the jury, unless there's any questions.
Is it a question of fact or of law?
I believe it's a question of fact. It's a defensive issue. It's just like self-defense. If he wanted to argue that the state couldn't prove that the first indictment told the second indictment, he needed to get a jury charge on that issue. Thank you.
I regret that the state is maintaining its argument that the matter was not preserved because they just told you it was not presented to the trial court, that specific argument was not presented to the trial court. It was three times. I'll read it. It's the same paragraph in each document. Attempt to toll statutes of limitation. The indictment in this cause includes a tolling paragraph. Charging the defendant with an offense arising out of the same conduct and thus tolls the statute of limitations from that date. It goes on for another page, citing authority, including Ex parte Slavin, Prince, and Hernandez, all of which have to do with tolling paragraphs. How could the state possibly not be on notice that his complaint includes the tolling paragraph? It includes both things. Both are necessary to toll the statute of limitations in this case. The title of the writ and the motions are motions to dismiss because the statute of limitations, because the prosecution is outside the statute of limitations. I don't see how this cannot be preserved or what more we could have done. It's not a jury matter unless there's a factual dispute, and there was not. On the indictment issue, when to read it. The state's still relying on Studer. Studer, as the Court of Criminal Appeals, has now delegated it to, quote, bookcase status. So you have Studer on one end at one extreme, which says just about any document's going to be an indictment. At the other extreme, you've got Cook, where they left out the person's name. So they were forced. They said, this is too much. That's a quote from the court. Because how can they justify that as an indictment? Here is their test. They talk about notice. Is it given notice to the defendant? They phrase it in various ways, the court does, in Teal. They finally come down to it in this on page 182 of the 181 of the opinion. Thus, the complete test for the constitutional sufficiency of a particular charging instrument goes slightly further than that expressly set out in Studer and Cook. Can the district court and the defendant determine from the face of the indictment that the indictment intends to charge a felony or other offense for which a district court has jurisdiction? So that's what you're looking for. And unfortunately, when you look at the first count, you know that that's not even an offense. There's no authority for private lawsuits to also be criminal prosecutions. The second count, which leaves that part out, is incomprehensibly written. You can see it, you can make the case for at least three offenses that they were trying to allege, but you can't conclude which one it was. And finally, none of the allegations in that, every allegation in that first document was focused on the specific facts of what Ms. Ahmad did. And what she did was she planted a fake, not a fake, a real World War II bomb, not a fake bomb. Yet she's prosecuted for and convicted for possession of a fake and hoax bomb. On sufficiency, just very quickly, I did put in the legislative history of hoax bomb, and I would simply point out that you had, in that legislative history, it reflects why the legislature thought it necessary to create a new statute of possession of a hoax bomb, and that was because the present statute of possession of real bombs didn't cover them. They needed a new penal code offense. That's all I have.
Any questions? Thank you. We appreciate your argument. Your case is submitted. You're free to go about your business, and this court will be adjourned.